Thank you. Is the microphone on?
Yes.
Awesome. All right, so until the battery runs out. Okay, so we got the technical stuff mostly worked out. This, as you know, these Beamer talks are supposed to have things appearing and disappearing, and somehow it's going to sort of scroll up and down, so the magic is lost. But, you know, there's still magic in the world, but it's just not here. We can all tell lots of stories about John later on. For now, let me just say this is in honor of his 70th birthday. And as a special treat for John, even though I'm American, I did put the U in honor for him, so right here. So this one's for you. It's red, but we could turn the lights off more and make it more red if we wanted. Okay. Yeah. All right. And since this is scrolling instead of overlaying, I guess I need to go. So I'd like to talk to you about, linear independence of zeros of Dirichlet L functions. So let me just start by reviewing some sort of classical facts about zeros of L functions. And then we'll get on to some work. By the way, this is all joint work, either done or in progress with Nathan Ng at the University of Lethbridge. So everything I say today will be joint work with him. So let's just talk a little bit about zeros of Dirichlet L functions in general. So here's your Dirichlet L functions. Some of what we're talking about, if you like other kinds of L functions too, like a lot of people in this room do, then maybe there are some extensions possible. This is sort of more comfortable ground for me. But it's classically known that in the critical strip, every Dirichlet L function has infinitely many zeros. And of course, we have a pretty specific conjecture about the horizontal distribution of those zeros. We think they all lie on the same vertical line, the critical line. And I just want to point out something that is relevant to this talk, but is usually not relevant, is that this is actually sort of a two-way conjecture. It both makes an analytic statement about the horizontal distribution, namely that it's a delta function, but it also makes an algebraic statement about the horizontal distribution. There's a certain symmetry. It makes this a rational number. Now, that's kind of silly to say about GRH, but it's a distinction that actually does make a difference when we talk about the vertical distribution. So analytic statements about the vertical distribution, these are things that we know a reasonable amount about, and we have some conjectures as well. So for example, we have an asymptotic formula, which is written incorrectly on this slide. This should be a t log t. So if you let the constant depend on t, then that works. But the number of zeros up to height t is about t log t with a constant depending on the character. And in fact, even in a very short interval, an almost bounded interval, we know how many zeros there are asymptotically. Not quite bounded, but almost. And we have conjectures, for example, of the gaps between the ordinates, between the imaginary parts of the zeros. We even have some things we know or would like to know about the n-level correlations. And the point I want to make about this, because I'm not really going to talk about any of this, nor am I going to prove the GRH, is that these are analytic statements. These are distributional statements that would... It doesn't matter if they fail 0% of the time. These statements aren't going to, well, the second one, for example, won't pick that up. But nothing in here actually talks about the algebraic nature of the ordinates, of the imaginary parts. Now, there's something that we believe, or at least, you know, after a beer or two, we'd be brave enough to say, perhaps, is we think that these imaginary parts as algebraic objects shouldn't have anything to do with anything. Each ordinate should just be a new transcendental number that never had anything to do with anything you've seen before. So, for example, let's talk about the Riemann zeta function for a slide. Let Z1 be, so the Canadians are all like, why is he looking so strange? We'll take up that challenge on the curling rink.
I thought it was a capital zeta.
A capital zeta, yeah. Well, I guess when I have a Greek postdoc, maybe it will be. So, okay, so let's let, okay, I can't keep this up, I'll talk. Let's let Z1 be... just the set of zeros of the zeta function, but we don't want to count the same zero four times or whatever because of symmetry and functional equation. So let's restrict the real part to be at least a half, the imaginary part to be non-negative. We know what happens in those other three quadrants. And let S1 be the set, or rather the multiset of imaginary parts, because in complex analysis we're used to just listing the zero multiple times if it's a zero with high multiplicity. So this is technically a multiset. And we're going to ask about the imaginary parts. That's what S1 is. And the conjecture, which for a couple of slides we'll call Li1, Li for linear independence, is that these imaginary parts are linearly independent over the rational numbers. So S1 is a linearly independent set over Q. This is an extremely speculative conjecture. In fact, part of the motivation for Nathan and I looking at this stuff is that we wanted to at least produce some reasons, some hard reasons why you might want to think this, not just, well, you know, I don't know why it wouldn't be. So this Li1, which is not a name that anyone should use, including me, it has appeared before for the zeta function. So Vintner, for example, and other people, Montgomery, Monach, probably others as well, use this to study the limiting distribution of the error term in the prime number theorem. So there's a normalized error term in the prime number theorem. This thing has a distribution function. It's not literally bounded, but it's bounded on average. And we can understand that distribution function better if we assume that the ordinates are linearly independent. On a related note, Ingham showed that if we assume the linear independence of these ordinates of the zeros of the zeta function, then we have this lim sup going to infinity. This function here is the Mertens function m of x, and in particular, this linear independence hypothesis, Ingham showed that it disproves the Mertens conjecture, which at that time was, I think, reasonably well believed, that this m of x, this summatory function of the mu function, is always less than root x. And since then, Odlyzko and Cirilla used Ingham's ideas, and some of their own, of course, to unconditionally disprove the Mertens conjecture with constant 1, at least. And they did this using, essentially, investigating linear independence of small zeros, so numerical linear independence. So this is something that has at least come up before in the context of the zeta function. So I guess they didn't literally verify that they're linearly independent for real, but they verified that no linear combinations with integers up to a certain height equals zero, and then did some pretty smart stuff to conclude what they wanted from that. So yeah, so this is very hard to study numerically because even if you take the first two zeros of the zeta function, how do you prove they're linearly independent? No amount of finite computation that we know how to do will do that. So yeah, this is a tricky business. So good, the bar is set nice and low for the rest of my talk. It's hard to do. But let's do the same game with Dirichlet L functions. So for analogously, for any character chi, you can define the set of zeros. Again, we're going to stick to this northeast quadrant within the critical strip. And S sub chi will be the set, or the multiset rather, of ordinates, of imaginary parts of those zeros. And further, if we take the union over all primitive chi mod q, that gives us an SQ. And then if we further take the union over all moduli q, then we get the set we'll call capital S. And the reason we restrict to primitive is just so that we don't count the same zeros over and over again every time it induces a new character. And then the speculative conjecture, which we'll call Li for linear independence, is that this set of ordinates of all zeros of all Dirichlet L functions in the world, is linearly independent over Q. We don't have any particular reason to think otherwise. In fact, we probably think it's algebraically independent, but let's stick with linear for now. I think the first place this conjecture appeared is in an article of Hooley from the 70s. And Rubinstein and Sarnak, in their great paper, Chebyshev's Bias, used this to study prime number races. So under this assumption, they get some really nice, and GRH, they get some really nice information on prime number races. And I'll come back to that at the end of the talk. What are some things that would be true if this linear independence hypothesis is true? Well, one thing about a linearly independent set is that it shouldn't contain zero. So one consequence of Li is that L1/2 chi is never zero. And this is something that we at least have some theoretical evidence for, which is nice. So for example, for real characters, this was conjectured by Chawla in the 60s, and Sound proved that at least 7/8 of real Dirichlet characters fail to vanish at the half point. So at least this is some theoretical evidence in support of Li. If you look at all characters now, say all, well, this result, at least 34% of even primitive characters with prime conductor don't vanish at the half point, a very recent result of Bui. And this builds upon work of Ivanets and Sarnak, and also Balasubramanian and Kumar Murthy. So non-vanishing at the central point is one consequence of Li. At least we have some theoretical evidence for that. And also we kept saying multiset because we might list these zeros with multiplicities, but if the multiset contains the same element twice, that's not linearly independent either. So in fact, if you believe Li, then you have to believe that the zeros are all simple. And moreover, that different Dirichlet-L functions don't share a zero. And at least the first part of this conjecture, the simplicity of the zeros, is again something we have some theoretical evidence for. If you, for any Dirichlet character LS chi, at least a third of the zeros are simple, and in fact simple n on the critical line. This is about a 10-year-old theorem of Bauer. If you just look at the zeta function itself, then you get at least 41% by Bowie, Connery, and Young. So some of you know about these problems, and the percentages have been getting kind of macroscopic recently, which is nice. If you assume GRH, then you get at least 11/12 of the zeros of LS chi are simple. And if you don't just fix your LS chi, but look at all characters to all moduli at the same time, then a very recent result, Connery, von Itz, and Sound say at least half of the zeros are simple. And on the critical line, probably? Okay, so I think that's true. Anyway. Okay, so these are some consequences of Li. 58%. There you go. That's 7/12. Almost. More than 7/12. Well, there you go. Okay, so Nathan and I were like, okay, well, is there any other way that we can maybe produce some evidence that this Li in its grander scale should be true? Maybe not statements about individual zeros, but something else. So the thing I want to talk about in the second third of the talk is arithmetic progressions, vertical arithmetic progressions on the critical line. So what does that look like? It just looks like a half plus I times an arithmetic progression of numbers. And if you believe this linear independence conjecture, then you'd better believe that you don't have three zeros in this arithmetic progression. Any three points in the arithmetic progression are linearly dependent. I guess I should say somewhere that A and B are rational numbers. So they're linearly independent over Q. In fact, if A is zero, if it's a homogeneous arithmetic progression, then it only better have one zero. And of course, you can make two zeros. Just pick your two favorite zeros and fit the arithmetic progression through them. Okay. So looking at non-zero values of L functions in vertical arithmetic progressions is something that has been done a little bit. Putnam, a long time ago, proved that the zeta function in an arithmetic progression half plus IKB, at least it's not zero infinitely often. So there's not a vertical arithmetic progression consisting entirely of zeros of the zeta function. That kind of goes to show how much we don't know about this, about the algebraic nature. Lapidus and van Frankenhuysen in 2000 proved that there's actually a substantial number of points in this arithmetic progression that are not zero. So they get t to the 5/6 of these values are non-zero. If you assume GRH, they can get t to the 1 minus epsilon. And they're actually, their methods are more dynamical than number theoretical, right? This is somewhere where the dynamics people have been kind of ahead of us. But it's not a question that's really been looked at very much. Okay, so Nathan and I finally decided to look at this, and this is a theorem that this is on the archive and hopefully will be accepted to your favorite journal soon. So let chi be any Dirichlet character. A and B are real numbers with B non-zero. Then the number of the first t values of LS chi in this arithmetic progression, at least t over log t of them are non-zero. So this is our theorem. So this is a bit stronger than the previous result. And in fact, we can do this without assuming GRH, so that's kind of nice. Also, our method applies to non-homogeneous arithmetic progressions, so we don't have to center it on the real axis. It can start anywhere you want. It's a true fact that our method actually works on other vertical lines besides the critical line, but it turns out you can do much better than that using stuff we already know. If you have a zero density result for your L function, then that proves that almost all the points are not zeros of the L function. So rather than trying to prove lots of them are zeros, you can actually go over the hump and start proving like upper bounds on the ones that are zero. You get a power savings here. So we'll just state it for the central line. Now, we'd really, 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 really like to show positive proportion here. We're only missing by a log. And, you know, it kind of sounds lame to say we tried really hard, but we tried really hard. But this is still an open problem. It would be great if someone could figure out a way to get a positive proportion instead of just t over log t. I'm sure that we can. Well, okay, I'm pretty sure that we can. It's not going to have, In fact, the next slide will be something explicit, which is slightly different, so that might give you a flavor. So I think this is certainly effective, yeah. So, and here's an example of something we can do that's explicit that we bothered to do. If you take an arithmetic progression, then now just say, how far do you have to go before you hit a point that's not zero? Of course, we think the answer should be 3, but what can we prove? So Watkins actually has an unpublished argument that gives a bound for the least k, the least k that you have to go and find a non-zero point. And we have a theorem of in this regard as well, the same methods. So let chi be a Dirichlet character, and now let's just restrict a to b, let's have them be positive and a less than b, so we really are talking about arithmetic progressions that kind of start on the near the real axis. Then we can find a pretty small integer such that the kth point in the arithmetic progression is non-zero. Small is like q to the 1 plus epsilon in the conductor aspect, and then if b is greater than 1, it's like b to the 3 plus epsilon. We can also take b very small. B is like 1 over a million or something, so there's a different bound if b is small. But some polynomial bound. We can be more precise with the 1 plus epsilon, I just didn't put on the slide. But for example, if you just want to look at the zeta function, then you can get a bound something of this shape, b cubed times this is a specific b to the 3 plus epsilon. And in this form, the way I formulate it here, I have to put the 1 in, because if b is tiny, then this is like going to 0. That's no good. So, of course, the zeta function doesn't have a 0 below like 14, so if b is really tiny, you're going to be fine no matter what. Okay, so this is at least something a little bit more explicit. Okay, and just an outline of the strategy of the proof, it employs a technique that a lot of you have definitely seen before. So just to set some notation, here are the points in a vertical arithmetic progression, and it turns out just to be convenient to take this 2 pi out, but this is the same progression you saw before. And let's define a couple of mollified moments here, S1 and S2 of t. So S1, for example, sums the values of L over this arithmetic progression, except we weight them by a mollifier of a familiar type. This mollifier goes up to some unspecified, as of now, length x, and it's something that we think mimics the behavior of 1 over LS chi. So it's a partial sum of mu of n chi of n over n to the s, and then a continuous cutoff function here. And so we take the first mollified moment and then the second mollified moment with the modulus here, modulus squared. And then we do one of our favorite tricks. We use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. And we notice the very trivial fact that when we're summing all these values, in fact, it's the same as summing over the ones where they're non-zero, because the zeros contribute zero. Twice nothing is nothing. So if you apply Cauchy-Schwarz to this sum, then you can get a sum of ones and a sum of the modulus squared. And of course, here again, it doesn't really matter that we're summing over non-zero terms, because the zero ones vanish. So this is our familiar trick of using Cauchy-Schwarz to get a lower bound. The number of non-zero terms is at least the square of the first moment divided by the second moment. So if we can get a lower bound for the first moment, an upper bound for the second moment, then we get a lower bound for the number of non-zero values. So let's hide lots and lots of details. We'll do the one slide. So again, here's the first and second moments. And it doesn't matter a whole lot what we take x to be, as long as it's less than t to the half. So let's say t to the quarter. We in fact can get an asymptotic formula for the first moment. It's asymptotically t. And we get an upper bound for the second moment, t log t. I'm sorry?
I mean, that's what the modifier.
Yeah, so this we had a fun, Steve remembers, we had a fun conversation about this in Calgary a few months ago. One of the reasons we want to mollify is to get rid of this log. Yeah. And it doesn't seem to work, but in a way, but it should. It usually does. So, like, we tried, couldn't get it to work, but if someone said this is a way, we would just take off our hats and say that's great, you know.
So what happens if you don't include the mollifier?
That's a great question. If you don't include the mollifier, I think if you work really hard, you can still get the same t over log t. So, in fact, even though we thought the mollifier was going to improve our result, it ends up just making it easier to prove this result. So, for example, without any mollifier whatsoever, and then you could also ask the question, why do you have the smooth cutoff function instead of no smooth cutoff function, if you want to sort of mollify weakly versus strongly. But with no mollifier whatsoever, for example, you can still get a lower bound of order t for this, which is all you need, but the asymptotic will actually depend, for example, on the spacing. if you imagine that you take an arithmetic progression of points exactly so that the 2 to the minus s term is constant, then it's going to modify the asymptotic formula here. I don't think it's anything you couldn't surmount, but the modifier turned out to make it easier on us. So even when we discovered it doesn't make the theorem better, we're like, well, why don't we just still do it this way? Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it would be great to find it to work. There is this phenomenon where, in fact, how we do this is that we convert it to an integral using Gallagher's lemma, and then we actually get an asymptotic formula for the integral. So is this log t coming from the Cauchy-Schwarz, or is it actually coming from the fact that we have a discrete sum and not a continuous sum? And if the latter, then maybe there's some problems. Anyway, yes. Oh, I see. Yeah. So with that different problem, it's a lot more continuous than discrete. So maybe this is kind of coming from the fact that it's discrete. Yeah. But on the other hand, maybe there's a way to get around it. I plan on living a while longer and seeing. Anyway, there's where the t over log t comes from. Just briefly talk about some other work in progress that Nathan and I have. The first one is a very similar theme. So again, we're trying to find some evidence for this linear independence hypothesis. So another thing we can do is take some fixed linear form. So let's let a 1 up to ak be positive rational numbers. And if we believe the linear independence hypothesis, then whenever gamma 1 up to gamma k are imaginary parts of zeros of LS chi, then if we take a rational linear combination of them, we shouldn't get another zero of LS chi. So for example, if you just take a single multiple of a single gamma, whenever A is a rational number, I guess we should exclude 1 and minus 1, then we expect a half plus I A gamma not L of chi not to be zero if gamma is an ordinate. And in fact, someone actually did verify this one for A equals 2 for the zeta function for a pretty large number of gammas. You can imagine doing this for your own favorite L function. Or you can take, say, the average of k zeros, and this average should not be another zero of LS chi. Or you can just take any linear form you want. It should never be a zero, so can we prove it's often non-zero? And if you take a similar method, let's let this notation I sub chi of t just denote the ordinates of zeros up to height t of the L function LS chi. And we have an asymptotic formula. This time I remembered the t, so that's good. But t log t. And let's try the same strategy again. We just sum all the L values over the k tuples of gammas. And we have a first moment where we simply sum them, and we have a second moment where we sum them mod squared. And by the same Cauchy-Schwarz trick, if we get a lower bound on the first and an upper bound on the second, we can get a theorem on how many times this L function doesn't vanish at this linear form in the gammas. Sorry. Did I still get it wrong? Oh.
That's the right when t is 1. Most important thing.
Cool. It's right when t is 0, so I'm good. It's right when pi is infinity? Oh, okay. Okay, so in a circular argument based on the fact that I can't write the n of t thing down. So we have a preliminary theorem, And the preliminary theorem says, okay, let's assume GRH, so we know they're all on the half line, and fix these numbers A1, AK just between 0 and 1. We think we can be looser about that, but just for technical reasons. Then we can get asymptotic formulas for this first and second moments. And the first moment is just the number of terms, and the second moment is one log bigger than the number of terms. And so the corollary, by the same Cauchy-Schwarz argument, on GRH, if you fix these A's between 0 and 1, then the number of points that we don't get a 0 is just one log shy of positive proportion. By the way, it's amusing to note that this theorem doesn't have anything to do with the A's being rational or not. I mean, rational has to do with Li, but the theorem holds perfectly well even for your favorite irrational numbers. We're still trying to figure out exactly what we can do here, but we're pretty sure that we don't need all the gammas to come from the same L function. We could take k different L functions and use their gammas and then test it at a k plus first L function or something. I think the method goes through. So we can do stuff like that. And you notice that we didn't mollify a few slides ago. Maybe if we mollified, maybe this one will work out. Maybe we're a little more hopeful we can get this to get rid of this log t, but we don't know yet. And then very briefly, the prime number races. So what is a prime number race? Prime number race has to do with inequalities of this form, where we count primes in arithmetic progressions, and we look at whether certain inequalities hold, whether they come in a certain order. So let's say that a prime number race is inclusive if, no matter how we permute the R residue classes, then there are arbitrarily large values of X where the prime counting functions come in this order. There are R factorial different orders we can get, and all of them occur infinitely often. That's what an inclusive prime number race is. And one of the things that Rubinstein and Sarnak proved is that every prime number race is inclusive. To do so, they assume not only GRH, but also the full strength of the linear independence hypothesis. And Nathan and I were saying, can we actually prove this with a weaker hypothesis? In fact, we started out saying, can we actually break this if we're evil with where the zeros are? But we ended up doing this. So we're going to try to weaken the Li hypothesis. So for notation, let's let just I of chi be the set of all ordinates of the zeros of Ls chi without bounding the height by t anymore. And I of q is just the set of all ordinates over all characters mod q. And let's call one of these ordinates self-sufficient if we can never write it as a linear combination of other zeros. Nathan and I are having a fun time trying to figure out what terminology to settle on here. And just for this talk, let's use the notation I spade of chi just to denote the set of self-sufficient ordinates.
What do you call it if it's self-sufficient and comes from a pretentious
parent? I just call a spade, John. So let's let I spade of Q be the set of all ordinates. Thank you. I'll be here all week.
I heart characters.
I heart characters? That'd be good too. This is being recorded for posterity.
Last time we get money.
Yeah. Okay. Just as a sort of reality check on the definition, let's just note that the statement that all these ordinates are self-sufficient, that's actually, it says that I spade Q is a linear independent set, but it's actually a stronger statement than that, because it also says you don't get linear relations even if we try to use these other guys, these other ordinates. So in fact, what this actually is, it's I spade of Q, it's the intersection of all maximal linearly independent subsets. In matroid theory, this is called the set of co-loops. I wish I didn't know that. Okay, so here's a couple of examples of theorems that we can prove. We're assuming GRH here. If every non-principal character, chi mod q, has the property that the reciprocal sum of the imaginary parts diverges if you sum only over the self-sufficient ordinates, if that diverges for every character, then we can recover the Rubinstein-Sarnak result that every prime number race is inclusive. The sum over all ordinates diverges at speed about log squared t. So this says that if you have a subset of those zeros, even of density like 1 over log squared t roughly, as long as you have that many linearly independent zeros, self-sufficient zeros, then that's still enough to prove the prime number race is inclusive. This is actually for every non-principal character. If you think about the explicit formula, the principal character is kind of a wash. It doesn't affect the relative ordering, so we don't ever care about that character. Another example is if you just want to look at a two-way prime number race, so A and B are distinct reduced residues, then we don't need something to happen for all characters, we just need one sum to diverge. So the sum of over self-sufficient ordinates of 1 over gamma, just over all characters where chi of A is not equal to chi of B. These are the characters that affect the explicit formula of the difference. So as long as that one sum diverges, then the two-way prime number race will be inclusive.
So this is replacing the Li hypothesis?
Right, this is weakening the Li hypothesis, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Just as a simple challenge, just to emphasize how little we really know about this, my colleague Lior Silverman pointed out that the following problem is still an open problem. Prove that there's one irrational ordinate anywhere. I don't know how to do it. Maybe every Dirichlet L function, including the zeta function, maybe they all of the imaginary parts are rational. I don't know. So on that note of ignorance and lack of hope, if you want to check out these slides, hopefully with the NFT form is corrected, or the paper that Nathan and I submitted, you can go there to my webpage. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Greg. Time for questions.
Three? More? Which violated you, yes. So Nathan and I were trying to do what they did. I should have mentioned this, that we were spurred by the Ford-Kanyagan construction, and now there's another paper by Ford, Lamsery, and Kanyagan, right? Of if you put zeros off the half line in very specific places, you can break prime number races, you can make them not inclusive. So Nathan and I were trying to say, hey, what if we just, if we keep everything on the critical line, then can we still make some configuration of zeros that breaks prime number races? And so our result is kind of like saying, if you're going to do that, you have to use 100% of the zeros to break it. We thought we could maybe do it with less, but we don't know how to do it, but you'd have to really, really have lots and lots of linear combinations. So that's one way of interpreting that top result there.
Thank you.